Hello, and welcome to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. These podcasts explore some of the issues and events that are impacting ourselves, our families, and the Jewish world at large in light of the current revolution in aging. And of course, we invite your comments and suggestions to Rabbi Address at jewishsacredaging.com, our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging, or the Jewish Sacred Aging podcast page on Facebook. And our homepage, which we invite you to take a look at, is www.jewishsacredaging.com. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome to today's podcast, calling in from beautiful San Francisco, Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter, the founder of Endwell out in San Francisco. Dr. Ungerleiter, thank you for joining us. Welcome. Welcome to Seekers of Meaning.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to hear you, and I thank you for your time. I guess the easiest first lead-off question is, what is Endwell?
Endwell is a symposium that brings together the worlds of design, of technology, of healthcare, of policy, spirituality, patient advocacy, law, media, educators, all with the goal of generating interprofessional solutions to making the end-of-life experience more human-centered. So we have 600 attendees joining us in December from all over the world, from different backgrounds, coming together to discuss what it means to live well until the very end. And we will have 20 incredible speakers lined up who will give very engaging, fast-paced talks throughout a really full day with some art and music woven in. Think like TED, but for end of life.
Wow. And this, you do this all in one day?
All in one day.
Wow. It's like a TED Talks on steroids, it sounds like. That's a lot. So, and you hold this every year?
Well, we started last year. So this is our second event.
Well, it's every year. So, and this is in San Francisco?
It is.
Okay. And people come from, is it more local or is it more global, national, North American?
You know, I think there's a lot of California-based folks that come just because it's easier to get here. But we had an international audience last year. We had people who heard about us somehow from Japan, from Brazil, from the UK. I think we had someone come from China, from Canada. So we're expanding our audience to be much more international than I would have imagined.
And do you stream this conference?
We will this year.
Okay, cool. And so you'll be sending out, and we'll be happy to, put that on the Jewish Sacred Aging website too, if it helps. Helps you.
Wonderful.
You're a medical doctor. I think you told me you're an internist hospitalist at a hospital in San Francisco, mm-hmm. internal medicine. What was, and I was fascinated with this with people, what was the tipping point in your career that clicked on your soul to say, I want to do this? This is a huge undertaking to take over to plan this. What was that point in your life that said, I got to do this?
Gosh. Well, I'll take you way back to my early days of residency training. So I really didn't set out to be an advocate for end-of-life issues. I actually thought I wanted to be a cardiologist. Not that you can't be an advocate for end-of-life and be a cardiologist, but I just didn't imagine I'd end up in this place. I had several experiences early on, actually, in my intern year, so my first year of residency that led me here, and many of them happened in the intensive care unit. And basically, I found myself taking care of many, many frail elderly patients who had several chronic illnesses plus end-stage liver disease or late-stage cancer. And they were being admitted to the ICU despite the fact that nothing we were going to do was going to really help them, right? We were unable to reverse their age, unable to reverse their underlying conditions. And honestly, they were spending their last moments of life suffering, hidden away from the people that they love. And I realized that this is the default thing that we do in this country. If you're a medical patient in the United States, you will receive just automatically aggressive, invasive care by default, right? No matter how old you are, no matter your underlying medical problems, and even if it won't help you. And we know that about 80% of people say they want to die at home, mm-hmm. and around 20% actually do. So the rest are dying, you know, in nursing homes, in hospitals, other facilities. A large percentage are spending their last days in the ICU before they die. And the majority of those people are dying in pain. And I feel like we're really failing our patients. And so I became interested in another way of caring for people, another philosophy. And that's really palliative care. So care that focuses on improving quality of life for people who are seriously ill, with a focus on their goals and their values, what's most important to them. So when I finished training, I founded a palliative care education fund to begin training all doctors at the hospital where I work, Sutter Health here in San Francisco. And so I think no matter what field of medicine you end up practicing, whether it is cardiology, primary care, nephrology, whatever, you really need a core competence in palliative medicine, in communication skills training. And so that was right out of residency. I started thinking about some medical education reform. And then I found myself going to all kinds of healthcare convenings, conferences to learn more about what was happening around the country. And I, you know, I think the good news is that there's amazing work happening and we're making a lot of headway around this topic. But I would say it's mostly siloed. Doctors talk to other doctors, hospice people talk to hospice people, insurers, you know, talk to other insurers, people in policy do their policy making thing, and nobody's talking to patients. And at every gathering, people talk about just how broken the healthcare system is. But the majority of what people imagine doing is just to rearrange or fine tune what we already have. And I realized that, you know, most of us inside and outside of healthcare have really internalized the idea that death is just a medical issue. So we keep looking for medical solutions. And I feel strongly that dying isn't a medical issue. It's a human issue. So I founded EndWell, the symposium, as a platform to invite really cross-disciplinary problem solving to transform policy, to transform care, transform cultural perceptions about, you know, how all these structures, whether it is social, political, can be furthered to support someone's goals and values at the end of life, and to really break down some of these silos, create a new network, new partnerships, and to really welcome new people into this conversation. And then, of course, to sort of highlight and support the people that have been doing this work for and working very hard for many, many decades. So that's how EndWell came together, my very long story there.
No. I work with also one of the other organizations that I work with is CTAC, the Coalition to Transform Advanced Care.
Of course.
I co-chair one of their spirituality and diversity working group. And I know that they also, along with a whole bunch of other organizations that seem to be popping up, I think the week before this airs, representative from the Conversation Project was on with us. What do you see is happening? Because there seems to be now a slow trickle of these organizations, groups focusing in on these types of conversations, many of which motivated for the exact same reasons that you are motivated. The system is broken. It's too medical and it's not personal. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of it, the Gawande book, and a whole bunch of other things too. What's going on in the country that's allowing this little trickle to start moving more rapidly?
Gosh, you know, I definitely have seen the same thing. I mean, the folks at the Conversation Project at CTAC are fantastic. We actually work with them for EndWell. So I love hearing that you're also a part of CTAC. I'm not sure exactly what's happening. I will say I know that I live in sort of a bubble, in that You know, I talk about hospice, palliative care, end of life, you know, all day long, every day. So I feel like I have some bias that maybe, you know, I think it's changing, but it isn't really. But I actually do. I mean, like you said, books like Being Mortal, When Breath Becomes Air, they sat on, you know, bestseller lists for years. Films like Extremis and Endgame that actually I was involved in executive producing are being bought by Netflix. These are things that people are wanting to watch and engage in, have conversations about. So there is something shifting. I'm not totally sure that we can tease out exactly what is the catalyst. I mean, we have 10,000 baby boomers turning 65 every day. So maybe it's that, you know, we're finally recognizing that this is an issue that we should all be engaging in. And I think, you know, in San Francisco, we're really lucky to have an amazing group of institutions, healthcare providers in the realm of palliative care and hospice, and to have designers like, you know, IDEO and major organizations thinking about this topic and really activated patients and caregivers. So I feel very fortunate to live on the West Coast because we all kind of work together and support each other and collaborate around this. So it's an exciting time for sure.
Do you think, because a lot of Jewish sacred aging work and was really emerged out of the aging of the baby boomers in the Jewish community, which is quite large. Do you think a lot of this is being driven by the baby boom generation who has had to deal or is dealing now with their own parents? They see some of the issues in the healthcare system and with that they've had to deal with as caregivers with their parents, and have in many ways said, I don't want that to happen to me. Do you think that's a possible catalyst for this?
I do. Absolutely. And we're seeing this really interesting, you know, sandwich generation of caregivers, right? Where people in their maybe mid-30s, early 40s, you know, have young children, and they're also caring for aging parents. And so they're really feeling the burden and recognizing, you know, gosh, I just don't want this to happen like how it happened with grandma or with, you know, auntie. Absolutely. But then I also, surprisingly, see a lot of young people, even millennials, engaging in topics related to end of life, quite surprisingly, because many of them are hopefully, you know, many, many years away from the end of life for themselves. So, you know, like organizations like Death Over Dinner or the Dinner Party, right, which brings together young people often to talk about, doesn't have to be, but often is young people talking about issues related to mortality, or websites like Modern Loss related to grief and bereavement.
Right. We just had them on the podcast a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, Rebecca and Gabby?
Yes, they were. Oh. Rebecca was on. Debbie couldn't make it. But Rebecca, it's on the website. It's archived as a podcast on Jewish Sacred Aging.
Rebecca is a dear friend. She's lovely. Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. They have a great book.
It's a great book.
Yeah.
Well, I just finished the new Barbara Ehrenreich book, Natural Causes. And she talks about, and you alluded to this, the medicalization of dying. And the flip side of that, which has occurred to me, and I want you, if you could unpack this a little bit, the medicalization of living. The fact that we're so into, I have to have these 7 tests, or I have to have that test. I need to have that more, as opposed to just saying, you know something, you can have all the tests you want, but maybe you're sacrificing the joy of living your life. Do you see that? In dealing with what you're putting together and in your practice, do you see this medicalization of living?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I have to say, I haven't read Barbara's new book, although I've heard amazing things, so I need to. Absolutely. I mean, I think especially in this country, and I think for in westernized, you know, in Western medicine, largely, we are so technologically advanced, right? In our approach to medical care, which is fantastic because honestly, we save lives every day because of it. People are very much focused on, well, I'm trying to think of the right way to describe it. I think because we can, you know, do more in terms of testing procedures, we sort of feel like everybody needs more. And because we have perverse incentives at play, right? In the United States, we're paid to do things to people, to perform tests, procedures, surgeries. That's how the system works. Mm-hmm. So it makes good sense that, you know, as a culture of medicine, how we're taught to practice medicine, we're very much focused on doing more and more is better, when absolutely more is not always better. And especially, you know, at the end of life, as I mentioned, I mean, I think that dying is a highly medicalized experience that's hidden away in our hospitals and other institutions. And, you know, 100 years ago, people used to die on their dining room table, surrounded by family. And I think specifically, you know, in talking about end of life, I mean, death is considered a failure in Western culture and in medicine. So as physicians, we're taught that, you know, if someone dies, it's because something went wrong. So we keep treating the disease or whatever the condition, rather than taking into consideration a person's quality of life. And as I said, it's not just aversion to failure that keeps us doing everything to keep people alive. Oh, those perverse financial incentives really permeate the culture of medicine. And it's really not, you know, not clear how all that care improves how long or how well people live. So especially at the end of life, people receiving aggressive medical care don't seem to live any longer. And some data suggests that, you know, a less aggressive approach buys people more time, and it's quality time. So absolutely, I need to read her book, and I'm pretty sure we're completely on the same page about these issues.
Yeah, we're speaking with Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter, the founder of Endwell, an internist and a hospitalist at Sutter Health in San Francisco. And we're talking about Endwell in the symposium, the annual symposium. And just let me just return to that, doctor. The symposium is scheduled for San Francisco. What are the dates?
It's December 6th of this year, 2018, in San Francisco. We have the symposium at a venue, a gorgeous state-of-the-art venue called SF Jazz, right in the heart of San Francisco. And you can find us online at endwellproject.org. We are on LinkedIn and Facebook at Endwell Project. We're on Twitter and Instagram at EndwellSF. And then all of our content is on YouTube at the Endwell Design for the End of Life Experience channel as well. And so we're about to make some big announcements in terms of our speakers and our program very soon. And last year's symposium, which was our first year, kind of an experiment to bring together such a diverse group of speakers and attendees, it sold out 4 months ahead of time.
Wow.
It shocked us. So we encourage people to sign up early if they want to join us. And we're really looking forward to another wonderful year.
And let me just ask a very tachless practical question, because... is there a cost to register for the conference?
There is. So we function as a nonprofit. And I'm sure, as you know, it is incredibly expensive to put on large scale events. So there is a charge. But I will say, you know, we barely come close to breaking even on this event. It's all about education and doing good work for the world. That's our goal. I would encourage folks to just check out the website and see if it works for them.
Okay. That's good to know. And again, the website, endwellproject.org, to connect you with the symposium and, I guess, registration information, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
In your work, Dr. Ungerleiter, you just started to allude this. I want to pursue it a little bit. There's this tension in a lot, and we weren't in some of the work that we do in Jewish sacred aging on end of life from the Jewish perspective, the idea of just because you can do something doesn't necessarily mean in a particular context you should. It's very patient. It's very contextual. Can you walk us through some of your experience with in dealing with families who say, "Doctor, we have to do everything," and the tension of saying, "But what you're really doing is taking away a sense of peace and quality of life for your loved one by just constantly being aggressive."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will say those are some of the most challenging conversations that I've had to, that I've had to lead in my medical career. I think that in a moment, especially of crisis, having those kinds of conversations with patients, with their families is so difficult, which is why sort of tangentially, we should be having these conversations very far upstream from the hospital, from an acute crisis moment, because you can't really make a thoughtful, reflective decision when the adrenaline is pumping and it's like, gosh, we need to figure out right now what to do. And then of course the doctors who are caring for you in the hospital, in the ICU, they don't know you typically. So it's so difficult. I like to sit down with patients, with family members, and really, when someone says to me, we want everything done for mom, I try to figure out, do they know what everything means? What does that look like? And sometimes they do. And for some people, that's okay. That's what they want. That is truly what they want. And we're definitely poised to offer that. I think, for many people, I take the approach of trying to find out what matters most to them. So who is this person in the bed largely, or who, if I'm talking to family, asking, tell me about your mom. How does she like to spend her time? Have you ever had a discussion with her about, if she were to become ill, what she might want out of her last several weeks, months, years? Tell me, what's most important to her? Because I think those are the kinds of conversations that can really help inform us as the medical providers. And then we can give a recommendation based on what those answers, are. But absolutely, I think it's such a challenging conversation, and, it's something that never gets easier. And, it turns out, amazingly, 70% of doctors, in a recent study surveyed, haven't been trained to have these difficult conversations, which, to me is a huge failure, of our medical education system.
One of our people who contribute to the website, Dr. Don Friedman, teaches this at Jefferson Medical School here in Philadelphia, this spirituality in medicine, and is also involved with organization GWISH out of George Washington University.
I know them well. Okay. They're fantastic.
So it does seem to be, a small little trickle on the part of the institutions, medical institutions, of trying to get this information into medical students and this seems to be somewhat recent in the history of medical education. Am I wrong in this, or are you seeing this? You're involved, on the West Coast and in San Francisco. Are you seeing programs in medical schools that are trying to address this issue? Spirituality,
yes.
The doctor as and more human as opposed to a technician.
Mm-hmm. They are. And as you said, it's just moving very slowly. I think permeating the culture of medicine takes so much longer than, other industries, other sectors. We just like to do things how we do them. And it's even getting, if there's a major study that comes out, with clear evidence that doing a procedure one way is clearly the right way, it takes, 20 years for the entire country to follow suit, even though it's obvious that that's how we should be doing things. So I'm not surprised that it's moving slowly, but, I think, We have a long way to go before, we are truly taking care of people in a way that is person-centered and really all about making sure that their goals and their values are honored in the medical care that they receive. Because to me, that's what it's all about.
I know the phrase patient-centered medicine or patient-centered care is very popular right now, which leads me to ask you, in your work professionally and also with the EndWell project and the symposium, can you speak to the role of spirituality? I'm putting on my rabbi hat, and as it relates to what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, you know this well. I think when serious illness happens, many, many people turn inward to cope. They try to make sense of what's going on and asking questions like, of course, why is this happening to me? What happens when I die? What's my purpose in my life? Are all very, very common. And I think for many people, these concerns become even, more important than when people are well. And I personally feel strongly as a doctor that to care for people, these needs have to be met. So the psychological, the social, the spiritual. And so palliative care teams always include a chaplain to support people. I think, of course, spirituality can be about organized religion. It can be, God, nature, community, humanity, or some other higher power. So it's not about, religion specifically. But I think, very often serious illness causes people to reflect on what it is that really matters to them in life and can often, translate to changed priorities for people in their last months, weeks of life. And to me, it's about supporting people to live as well as possible for as long as possible in a way that's in line with their personal goals and their values. So we talk a lot about that at EndWell. And for me personally, Judaism, of course, asks us to consider our own mortality, right? I mean, you can talk all about this, but on Yom Kippur, Jews all over the world wear white, right? The clothing to symbolize atonement and to remind us that someday that we'll be buried in white. Mm-hmm. And as our holiest day of the year, it reminds us that time is limited, that there may not be tomorrow. And I know that for me, being reminded of my own mortality makes life sweeter, richer, more miraculous. So that's just my personal feeling about things. But I think we as doctors tend to focus a whole lot on the physical body, and we just can't forget, the people live in a social context. They very, very often have some spiritual practice that, especially around end of life, becomes all the more relevant to address and support.
When somebody goes to a physician or checks into a hospital, there's usually a medical history outlining everything, et cetera, et cetera. In your experience working in this field, have you ever come across individuals or institutions who will be asked to fill out a spiritual history?
Ah, good question. I think I've come across one of those at some point. I'm trying to remember when, though. I it's definitely not common.
No, I know. It's something that I play with when we go out and teach about this stuff, and usually it's greeted with these sort of like blank looks. What is that?
Yeah, I will say whenever I have the privilege of listening to the nursing intake in the hospital, mm-hmm. The nursing team when they admit a new patient to the hospital, they kind of get them settled into their room and take a very thorough history, which includes, tell me about your religious life. Are you involved in organized religion? Are you into, how do you want us to address these issues? And it's fantastic. And it's sad to me that on the doctoring side of things, we're not doing
that. You have to check that out. Thank you. We're recording this, obviously, in the middle of May. It'll be posted in the beginning of June. Right now, as literally as we speak, there is a vote taking place in Washington, in the House of Representatives, on this right to try bill, which was passed by the Senate and now is in the House of Representatives. Do you have a personal, professional opinion on this right to try bill, which is going to allow, if it passes and is signed into law, an individual in terminal illness to short circuit FDA approval and try experimental drugs? Do you have an opinion on this?
Gosh, I am definitely not a policy expert, so this is not something that I've looked into extensively, I have to say. So I apologize.
It just is happening. I figured since you're dealing with this, I mean, it goes to the individual autonomy issue and how much choice does a person really, if this is my life, I'm diagnosed with a terminal illness, I've exhausted the arsenal of medicine. This is a possibility. I'm going to try it. I don't have to wait for the FDA to go through, you know, several years of trials. This may be my last hope. It seems to be working its way through the Congress. And I just thought I guess it goes back to how much choice and autonomy should a patient have over his or her own life?
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic question. I think, you know, with respect to sort of the FDA's process, I mean, short-circuiting the FDA could prove to be, you know, harmful for people, depending on, you know, the context and what it is that we're talking about. But I feel strongly that personal choice and autonomy, especially at the end of life, is incredibly important for people to sort of understand and have all options on the table. I think that's absolutely essential. So maybe the next time we talk, I can speak in a more intelligent fashion to the legislation.
I wanted to get your opinion because you know you're working in this in the conference and in your practice, and this is literally in the process of taking place. So, but it opens the door to one other real easy question. California had legalized medical aid in dying. And all I know, it's being challenged right now in the courts in California. We have a bill that's slowly working its way through the New Jersey legislature, medical aid in dying bill. Do you have again, following up on this little riff on individual choice and personal autonomy, do you have an opinion on the California bill?
You know, I think it's not such a simple question. I think it's a really complicated topic and obviously very highly controversial, even among palliative care physicians and other doctors. What I can tell you is that when individuals have more options available to them and they're having discussions related to their own end of life experience, I think we're on the right track. I am personally all for patient autonomy. And again, making sure that, you know, care is in line with their goals and their values. What I would love to see is palliative care be available and accessible to everyone. I think, you know, to me, that's my goal for this country is to make sure that, you know, everybody diagnosed with a serious illness is made aware of palliative care, meaning, you know, a team of nurses, doctors, social workers, chaplains that really focus on quality of life for people and their families facing serious illness. And you know, it can be used at any time during the course of illness, not just the end of life. And of course, if it can be years upstream from the end of life, people tend to have much better outcomes. So that's really what I hope for.
Yeah. And let me, we'll start to bring this to a conclusion too, because the palliative care issue keeps coming up. A friend of mine who just retired as head of palliative care at Fox Chase Cancer Center here in Philly, Mike Levy. We've had these conversations about the perception on the part of people when they hear the term palliative care. They immediately jump to, oh, that's just at the end of my life. But you just alluded to the fact that that's a misconception. It does have a powerful impact at the end of life. But palliative care is really comfort care. And is it not also at various stages of one's illness that can be so beneficial and caring?
Definitely. And you can receive palliative care along with curative treatment. So that's also what people don't necessarily recognize. I think we absolutely, as you first pointed out, we have a branding problem. Right. palliative care and hospice are seen as, you know, synonymous. Hospice is a form of palliative care, which is typically just if someone is within the last 6 months of their lives. And that's just a pretty arbitrary Medicare designation. But palliative care can, as I said, be used really at any time during the course of serious illness. And when used early and alongside other treatments, is it just an extra layer of support,
right,
for people and their families to focus on what matters most to them, to help treat things like physical pain, existential suffering around serious illness diagnosis, spiritual issues. I mean, all of it. And to me, it's like, who wouldn't want an extra layer of support helping them through a difficult time?
We've been speaking with Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter, the founder of EndWell, the EndWell Project, the symposium, the yearly symposium being held this year on December the 6th in San Francisco. And the website to check it out is endwellproject.org. Final question, real easy, another e-softball, Dr. Ungerleiter. What's the one piece of advice, if you could stop the world, take a look at everybody and their families and say, here's what you need to know about this issue of end of life. What would that one thing be?
Good question. To me, it's all about having a conversation with the people you love about what matters most to you. So if you haven't done that, talk to your family, sit down at the dinner table tonight, or call your closest friends, loved ones on the phone and say, gosh, you know, we don't know what tomorrow will bring. Let's just have a real conversation, about what matters to me. And hopefully, I guess I'm not sure what I want to say about that, but it can be a conversation that, you know, can bring people closer together and doesn't have to be morbid and dark. I think when I've sat down with my family and talked about it, there's lots of laughter and lots of love.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter, the founder of EndWell, the EndWell Project. Again, the website, endwellproject.org, for the symposium December 6th in San Francisco. Thank you, doctor. Thank you very, very much for your time and your expertise and your passion, and continued good luck and best wishes for everything. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank all of you for listening to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. This show and all others are archived on our homepage, jewishsacredaging.com. And again, I invite your comments to me at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com or on our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook, or the Jewish Sacred Aging podcast Facebook page. Again, we invite you to take a look at the homepage, jewishsacredaging.com, for articles, resources geared to baby boomers, our congregations, and our families. We welcome your contributions to the website and to the ongoing work of Jewish Sacred Aging. Seekers of Meaning is produced by Steve Lubetkin at the studios of Lubetkin Media here in beautiful Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And this is your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Thank you for listening. We look forward to contacting you and being with you on the next edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast for Jewish Sacred Aging. Take care. Shalom.